Okay, we're set to start. We have a wonderful woman on our staff named Patty, who if we had her here, she could whistle in such a way as to shatter most of the windows in this room. So thank you very much for not having me get Patty to make it quiet. I want to say hello and congratulate you and welcome you to Harvard. My name is Bill Fitzsimmons, and I'm the Dean of Admission and Financial Aid. I'm also a Bostonian, so I can tell you how to pronounce Harvard or Harvard. Let me ask a question. So how many of you are here at Harvard for the first time? Ooh, how about for the second time? Ooh, and how about for the third time? And how about more than 10 times? Okay, so there we have. We have a good bit of diversity. I grew up about 15 miles away from here, and I had never seen Harvard until my senior year in high school. So as I was going around on the circuit, I was a first-generation college student, and believe it or not, my high school, even though it is 15 miles from here, was very suspicious about Harvard. Now, you have to remember, this was a long time ago, and it was a Roman Catholic high school. But they said, wait a minute, Harvard is only for the rich. And you know what? In those days, it kind of was. Today, it isn't. They also said, gee, you know, if you go there, you're probably going to flunk out. And, you know, I went there, and of course, and today the graduation rate is 98%. And those great days was about 101% because it was much easier. But then, you know, another one was they said, if you go there, you'll lose your soul. So that was another way of sort of saying, you know, will you stay true to your religious background? And of course, the reality is I don't think religion has ever been stronger, not just on this campus, but many other campuses across the country. So the answer, of course, is yes, you can remain true to your background. The other one that was a more interesting one, especially for those of us from blue-collar and non-college backgrounds, but I think it's universal, will you be able to stay close and connected to your family? That was a very, very big item with us because we ran a gas station and a convenience store. So, you know, we all kind of worked together. And the fact of the matter is, my mother is 93. I see her about every other week. And you can indeed, you know, there are some of these literary questions about you can't go home again. The reality is some of the sanest and best people I've ever known are the people who can integrate all these great new experiences that they have in college and throughout their lives and integrate it well with their roots and where they're from. So in any case, the thing I worried most about superficially my first year was actually losing my Boston accent. So how do you think I'm doing? Do you think I've kept it? Can you say, park the car in Harvard Yard? That's the way you say it. How about Fenway Park for where the Red Sox play? Does that make sense? So I promise you, if you come to Harvard, I will give you individual lessons on developing a Boston accent. Last year, just about a year ago, my wife and I were running in the marathon, and we had to stop at 20 miles. And I won't go through all of the events of the past year, but I think one of the things that's pretty clear is that people, not just around here, but around the world, came to understand that Boston is a very, very special place. You know, the term Boston Strong, I notice now, is something that's being used in other parts of the country and other parts of the world. And in addition to being, you know, America's college town, it is really a very, very special and a very strong place. And it is a place that is so user-friendly and so young person-friendly. I would say Harvard and any of the other great places to which you've been admitted are all about making lifelong friendships. And these are friendships with students, and some of these friendships and lifelong friendships that you'll have will start this weekend. But there are faculty friendships. George Goethals, the chairman of my department, gave me 4 one-on-one courses and helped me get research that I more or less had my senior thesis done by the time I came back senior year, because he got me a summer grant. A lifelong friend who only passed away about 15 years ago. Al Gordon, a good friend of mine in the class of 1923 at Harvard, died when he was 107 not that long ago. But he said then, and I will say now, that one of the very best things about Harvard, and I think you could say about the college experience, is the friendships you make. And it isn't just friendships with people who can teach you a Boston accent. It has all to do with, let's just give you a quick overview of this class. So we have people from all 50 states for the great class of 2018. From D.C., from Puerto Rico, from the Virgin Islands, from Guam. We have citizens from 82 countries. Do we have any Canadians here? All right. A very, very special place. And as a former hockey player, I'm in great admiration. How about other international students? How about hands up for other international students? We have some, not as many as we will have. It's about 11% of the incoming class have foreign passport only, about another 4 or 5% have U.S. permanent residence, and another 4 or 5% are U.S. dual citizens. And for the plain old American citizens with American passports, just as in the American population, about 22% have a language other than English spoken in the home. Let me ask you, how many people are here from the U.S. from the West? All right. Of course, California is our biggest feeder. How many from California alone? All right. That's our biggest feeder these days. How about from the great Southwest? Oh, wait a minute. That wasn't so good. Come on, speak up. How about then from another part of the world, I think it's part of the United States, Texas? All right, okay, just checking. How about from the South? How about from Florida, just as a subset? Okay, and how about from the Midwest? All right, we refer to you in the admissions process as the children of the corn, as it turns out. How about the Mid-Atlantic? That includes you, D.C. All right, and how about from you-know-where, the East? And do we have any people from New York here? Are there any Yankee fans, New York Yankee baseball fans? One of the great things you can get by coming to Harvard is you can be near a winner here with a World Championship Boston Red Sox over the next 4 years. So let me just offer you congratulations. I'm one of about 60 people who considered your applications. We have about 20 faculty members. We have 40 admission officers and various financial aid admission officers, 27 of whom are women, 13 of whom are men. Admission officers here, would they stand up? I'll put their hands up if they would. Okay. We're already out on the road for next year. You know, as you know, you've probably seen us all over the country and all over the world. We obviously would love to have you come here. If you love red brick, we're your college. The more important thing really is, I noticed yesterday the Harvard Crimson, our great daily newspaper, wrote a very, very good editorial about finding the match and also really making your decision, not with a spreadsheet, but rather with your heart. And I think that's, you know, any really big decision probably should be made that way. So anyway, as much as we want you here, Harvard is so much better than it was even 10 years ago. But we know, because we travel with other colleges, they're all a lot better too. It's a great time to go to college, whether it's right down the street to our new best friend MIT or to lots of other great places. But one of the reasons Harvard is so much better than it was, say, 7 years ago, is because of President Drew Faust. And I would say that President Faust, in my view, Harvard, and she's only been here, it'll be 7 years this July 1. In my view, we have never had a better president than Drew Faust. I think she is an astonishing person. Let me just give you a couple of things that I find probably most interesting. Obviously, financial aid is near and dear to my heart, and she opened up Harvard within the first month or two of being president, opened up Harvard in a way it never has been opened up before with our revolutionary financial aid program. And it's a program that other places have adopted in various forms. It's helped to transform access to higher education, not just at Harvard, but across the country, and even across the world, as I've had various dealings with people from around and about. She also has been a critically important person in, as a national leader in trying to get more federal scientific research funding, which is a very serious problem for the country if we're not successful in terms of where our country will be a generation or two or three down the road. She's broadened Harvard's international outreach. We have offices now, it seems to me, in every country, in every part of the world. She also has raised the profile of the arts on campus, and she's embraced sustainability and environmental issues in a way that I've never seen this university so riveted on issues to do with the environment, and we're very lucky because we have the resources to do it. She also launched edX, you know, a MOOC, along with MIT, which I believe in the long run is going to revolutionize lots of aspects of higher education. She champions a thing that I was able to use a little bit in the 1960s called One Harvard. And that is that I took some courses at the Public Health School and at the School of Education. And she has opened up Harvard and its various schools and great research centers in a way Harvard has never been opened up before. And that's a huge priority. And finally, I would say I have never been prouder of Harvard or a Harvard president when during the economic downturn, when everything was falling apart, you know, our endowment, you know, had a huge decrease, Drew stood tall and said, well, there's one thing that we're not going to change no matter what, and that's going to be undergraduate financial aid. So she is also a great professor. She has won numerous teaching prizes. She's written 6 books. One of the books that changed my view of America forever was a book she did a few years ago that received all kinds of prizes called This Republic of Suffering. And it's about the Civil War. And if you want to learn more about the Civil War, that's great. This does it. But it also gives you a much better sense of what America is really like and what it was going through at the time. The best accolade I can give Drew is one from my mother. And that is, she's met Drew a couple of times. She's Drew's biggest press agent. And she said, and I quote this a couple of weeks ago, she's a real person. And that's the biggest and the best thing you could say about somebody in our little blue-collar community. But I am so proud to introduce President Drew Faust.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Harvard. Let's begin with a round of applause for Dean Fitzsimmons and all the other smart admissions officers who let you in. I've been hearing a lot about you over the past few weeks, and it's just great to see you here in historic Sanders Theater. You are, each of you, extraordinary, selected from a pool of 34,295 young people. And from that enormous group, we've chosen you. And we've done so because we think you belong here. And we hope that you decide to come to Harvard to share your energy and your talents as a member of this community. But this weekend isn't exactly a date of equals. We are committed, we've laid out the possibilities, and you're still deciding if you want to confirm our relationship status. Now, I think that many of you are probably confronting a tangle of feelings, and that's not unusual. You may be wondering, why here? Is Harvard the right place for the person I am and the person I want to become? Should this place be my home for the next 4 years? I want to help you think about those questions for the next few minutes. And I want to share some thoughts about the kind of institution that Harvard University is and the kinds of opportunities that it can offer to you. So what kind of institution is this? Harvard is a large research university, which means that it is dedicated to free thought and the discovery of knowledge and to the dissemination of that knowledge through teaching. Now, this means not just transmitting a vast store of accumulated knowledge, but also pushing beyond the world as we now know it, pursuing our riskiest insights and ambitions, and taking chances in unknown territories. Here, students are constantly surrounded by and participating in the creation of new ideas and new understanding. And you, as the remarkable undergraduates you are going to be, can be an essential part of this endeavor. Let me give you just a few examples. We recently opened something we call the iLab, the Innovation Lab, a space for entrepreneurs and innovators from across the university that's open 24 hours a day to anyone with a Harvard ID. Last year, three seniors in the college, actually as part of a class they were taking, developed a system to provide better flows of information on law enforcement data so that law enforcement officers could spend more time outside of the station house and away from their databases and more time using that data effectively in the community. This was so successful in Springfield, Mass., where it was tried out, that the three students decided to form a company. They entered a university-wide contest that I sponsor called the President's Challenge for Innovation. And they received a substantial award by winning that contest to invest in their idea. And they've now formed a company, and they are spreading the word about this system and their police forces around the United States that are adopting it. So that's pretty exciting to see a class project turn into something that has that kind of impact on the world. Or maybe you'd wind up having an experience like a student whose name is Jane Cheng. She's interested in books. She's interested in books to read, but she's also interested in books as objects, their history, how the appearance and nature of books has changed. So early in her undergraduate career, she took a job in the preservation and conservation department of the Harvard Libraries. And one day as she was doing her work, she saw a book that just really interested her, or perhaps I should say a series of books that really interested her, because she came upon multiple copies of the same text. This was a 15th century devotional tract called The Imitation of Christ. And it had so many different editions published between 1450 and 1550 that it can provide a unique window, the differences among those different editions, can provide a unique window into changing religious and cultural assumptions of that era. Jane got so interested in these that she wrote her senior thesis by putting together an exhibition of these books and publishing, as her senior thesis, a catalog for that exhibition. Or perhaps you might surprise yourself in another way, like a student I met with just about a week ago. His name is Enzo Vasquez Toral, and I had lunch with him and a number of his peers who've just won something called Harvard Artist Development Fellowships. And these fellowships support undergraduates to do special work during the summer to enhance their artistic capacities and opportunities and pursue their interests in whichever art, dance, music, theater that they specialize in. Enzo was originally planning to attend a theater school in Peru, which is his native country, but then he got admitted to Harvard. And here he found, as he describes it, the opportunity to explore and found an artistic home in a group here on campus called Harvard Teatro, which is a student-run organization focused on Spanish language theater. He also is studying Portuguese, one of more than 80 languages offered here at Harvard, and concentrating in Brazilian studies. And he, last summer with this artist fellowship, traveled to São Paulo in Brazil and completed an apprenticeship there at something called the Teatro Oficina. So he had a chance to pursue his dreams in theater and will be pursuing those further in the years to come. You can find opportunities like these in a variety of other venues and fields and activities, both curricular and extracurricular, all across the university. Harvard College offers more than 130 freshman seminars that might have you considering the philosophy of artificial intelligence, or you might find yourself printing at the university's vintage letterpress studio, or debating immigration policy, or learning the science behind sailing. There are all kinds of opportunities for you to connect with faculty who are themselves at the cutting edge of discovery and learning. These faculty have helped us select you, and they will help you explore the larger world through the classes and the other kinds of fellowships and summer programs and field stations that the university has to offer. One of the great treasures of Harvard are our museums in a variety of areas. Our art museum, which has been closed and being renovated for the last 6 years, is going to open next fall, and that will be a marvelous return of the campus to the treasures held in that art museum. But we also have natural history museums, scientific instrument museums, and we use these in classes in very exciting ways. We have one of the largest collections, for example, of bird specimens in the whole world. And as part of a class on biological diversity, Scott Edwards of the biology of our biology faculty and 13 of his students traveled to Panama to observe live birds, not just the dead specimens in our museum collections, and to understand more about their variety and their origins. So whether your interest is in anthropology or ornithology or economics or folklore, you will have access to rare experiences here on campus and elsewhere. You may notice that I've mentioned a lot of international engagement in this series of examples that I've offered. And this is an important commitment for us. We believe that every undergraduate student ought to have a significant international experience during the time they're at Harvard. And the number of students who have done so has more than doubled in the last decade. So we are grateful for the support of a marvelous gift from David Rockefeller that enables us to support international experiences for students regardless of their financial circumstances so that we can endeavor to make this possible for everyone. Now we know how much you like to achieve things, and Dean Fitzsimmons has an office full of documentation of how good you've all been at achieving things. You're all accomplished achievers, but that's not the only reason that we've chosen you. And should you choose to join us, achieving things should not be the only purpose of your 4 years here. Harvard should be about trying things in which you don't yet have any expertise, and things that you want to do with no particular achievement in mind. And I think that when Dean Fitzsimmons and his fellow admissions officers looked at you, what they looked for in part was that spark that said you would enjoy and benefit and thrive in a community where the opportunity to explore based on your curiosity and your imagination and your creativity would be at the heart of your experience. So if you come, we hope that you will nurture a whim or a passion for no apparent good reason at all, an ability to invent and maybe find something that will be meaningful for the whole rest of your life. So wherever you choose to go, your next 4 years ought to be a time when you try things out, a time for a bit of uncharted wandering, loosening up, taking a moment, and trying something new, trying something that you might never have imagined yourself doing before. We are a great place to do that. From our hundreds of courses to our hundreds of student organizations, you will find here a near infinity of possibilities. So back to the question, why here? I've offered a few answers, and as you spend the next day or two exploring our campus, keep asking that question. Try to imagine this place as your place. Listen with your heart, as Dean Fitzsimmons said, as well as with your head. And keep in mind the almost limitless possibilities in the classrooms, in the laboratory, in the library, in the museums, the wide array of extracurricular activities, and the kinds of people who you will meet here who will change your life. You may want to dive into music or athletics or public service. You may want to pursue sciences or social sciences or arts and humanities. But you will benefit from the broad array of things that we have to offer you here. I'm struck every year by the breadth and range of the classes we admit. Dean Fitzsimmons just gave a little geographical breakdown. He could have talked about a variety of other ways in which you represent such breadth and such capacity. This is an exciting time for us to think about bringing that here and about those of you who will be our accompanists for the next 4 years of all of our time together at Harvard. Harvard has a way of unfolding for each of us. It's a place that makes transformations happen for individuals and for communities. It's a place that we hope can enable people to find the very best in themselves and share that very best with others in ways that make for a better world. So thank you for considering Harvard. Have a great time, and I, of course, hope that every single one of you is here next year. Thanks so much. Thank you. I would be happy to try to answer questions. You will probably ask some questions that I can't answer, so that's why I've asked Dean Fitzsimmons to stay up here. If you ask me what are the requirements for a concentration in philosophy, you'll get a blank stare. So I'll do my best on the ones that are in my area. Dean Fitzsimmons will do the best on his. We may call on a few other people around the room as necessary, but we'll try to respond as we best can to whatever's on your minds. There are two microphones downstairs, and I think upstairs, for safety's sake, we will bring them to you. So wave your hands, and someone will bring you a microphone. No questions? Everyone knows everything about Harvard? Yes. Yes.
Thank you, President Foss, for meeting us today. My question is, what do you make of Harvard's role in the world today?
That's a nice, simple one. Harvard is a place that has a variety of roles to play in the world. Two very core aspects of our role involve teaching students in our undergraduate college and in our professional schools to be able to make significant contributions to the world in the fields in which they are being educated. So creating the leaders of tomorrow, the people who can be the doctors, the lawyers, the inventors, the public servants. We want to give those individuals the capacity to think expertly about their fields, but also the breadth to understand the human dimensions, the global dimensions of what they're they're undertaking. So that teaching, creating the next generation, is a very important part of what we do. A second part involves the research that goes on here. Just in the past couple of weeks, there have been some extraordinary discoveries made by scientists here at Harvard, and I just have been stunned thinking about them. In 1 week in the month of March, I learned that, first of all, one of our young faculty in astronomy had discovered aspects that help explain the Big Bang and the origins of the universe in a new way. I mean, what could be more fundamental than understanding where the universe came from? And this young faculty member had just made such an important advance in this domain that it was just all over the news. 2 days later, I'm told that a faculty member in the School of Medicine had just made a discovery about Alzheimer's and the way in which a certain protein in the brain seemed to have an inhibiting or enabling effect on the development of Alzheimer's. So it seemed to give a new understanding of means to pursue to prevent this terrible, terrible disease that is so personally devastating to so many people and so devastating to society more generally. So as I was thinking about those two discoveries, I was thinking about the hundreds of other faculty members who are doing research in the sciences, but also the humanities, the social sciences, that may yield a discovery that I'm hearing about next week or next month or 10 years from now that can have that kind of impact. So I think that's another aspect of what goes on here, discoveries that can make a really big difference in creating a better world. So people to lead a better world, knowledge to create the circumstances of a better world, those seem to me at the heart of what Harvard's role is in the larger universe. Thanks for asking that.
My name is Grigory. Thank you so much for your speech. And I wanted to ask you to maybe outline the future of the university, how you see Harvard in like 5 years, and what developments and changes do you plan? Thanks.
This is a time of enormous change in higher education for a number of reasons, so that all of the universities that are like us are going to be confronted with these transformations. One of the most significant is the whole new digital realm in which we operate, and we have some very exciting things going on here at Harvard through edX and HarvardX, which is our digital platform for teaching and learning, and it enables us to teach broadly throughout the world, but one of the most important parts of it is it enables us to think differently about what we do in our classrooms here. So how can we make learning more exciting, make teaching more interactive, more vibrant through all these digital opportunities? How can we have a class discussion that in live time includes students here in Cambridge with students participating from Tokyo or Beijing or Sao Paulo? What other kinds of ways can we flip classrooms and take advantage of new knowledge that also exists about how people learn to have more effective and exciting teaching? So the digital transformations are a big part of what we see evolving quite rapidly in universities. Another aspect is really implicit in some of the things I said in my remarks, and that's the increasingly global context within which higher education is operating. Students come here from all over the world expecting to live lives that will be international in their dimensions. They travel back and forth. We need to make sure we educate people in a way that gives them the languages, the understanding of cultures, the facility of movement that will enable them to be global citizens. So I think that is having a very big effect on what we do. Another aspect that is changing, and I think all of you can take advantage of that, is so many fields now are not separated one from the other, but rather intersect in important ways. If you think about the way the sciences are evolving, for example, if you think about something like bioengineering, it's life science, it's physical science joined together, boundaries breaking. If you think about some ideas that you might have about wanting perhaps to be engaged with global health, that's a big problem in the world. You as an undergraduate can do a minor, a secondary field in global health. It's the biggest one in the college, actually, biggest secondary field in the college. Almost 300 students taking advantage of courses offered through the School of Public Health, or faculty coming here from the School of Public Health to the college to teach. Also the medical school. Also things going on in the economics department within the college. Also input from people working on regulation in global health in the law school. So breaking down barriers among fields is important for the college. It's also important for how faculty do research and how the people in the professional schools understand what they're doing. So those are just three really big trends in higher education that are playing out in very significant ways here at Harvard. And I think you would see all of those trends having a very direct effect on your experience as it evolves in 4 years here. I think in 4 years, every single one of those is going to be in a different place from where it is today. And that's the great and exciting news about where higher education is right now. I can't see.
Hi.
Hi.
Can you tell me a little bit about what Harvard is doing to combat sexual assault on this campus?
Mm-hmm. As probably any of you who read the newspapers know, this is an issue of enormous concern in campuses all over the country. And we've had some changed legislation and regulation from the government that itself has required action. Interpretations of Title IX being offered through the Department of Education and its Office of Civil Rights, and also new regulations established by the Violence Against Women Act of last year. So we're doing a variety of things. We're, first of all, just adjusting our policies to meet those requirements and figuring out what the implications of that are for our disciplinary procedures. But I felt that it was extremely important for us not to simply respond to this regulation and to the notion of how one deals with sexual assault after it has occurred, but rather to take a very deep look at the issue ourselves and with the commitment that as a learning community, as a community that is all about feeling safe, to have ideas, to have experiences, to be a community, we needed to do everything possible to prevent sexual assault from occurring. So I've appointed a task force to look at that and to say, how can we as a broad community across Harvard, across all the schools, not just the college, do everything possible to prevent sexual assault from occurring? What are the conditions in which it happens, is most likely to happen? How can we prevent those? What are the circumstances where we might best be able to intervene before it occurs? How do we establish the values and commitments that will minimize the likelihood of its occurring? And also, I've asked that task force to look at how we respond, not so much in the disciplinary way that's being addressed in response to the Title IX questions, but rather in how we take care of people who've experienced sexual assault and how we try to minimize the trauma of that for people who have experienced it. So we're involved in a campus-wide conversation that I think is about processes and responses, but it's also fundamentally about values and about the kind of community we want to be. And so it's very much a live issue at Harvard right now in that way. I can't see very well, so if someone...
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. As a female president... Sorry. Hello, everybody. as a female president, can you discuss the history of women at Harvard, and both in the context of the admissions office and on campus itself?
Do you want me to go back? I'm a historian, so when you say history, you may really get history if that's what you're asking for. Do you mean like the last 10 years, or do you mean like back to the beginning?
Well, more just the fact that the context of myself, my mom could not realistically have attended Harvard, even though she was fully qualified. And so I just, if you could discuss where we are and where we are now, that would be great.
I can't resist doing a little history. Harvard College, there were always women at Harvard. That's the first thing we should recognize, because there were always women doing things like cooking and being part. Seriously. I mean, we should not fool ourselves that women did not contribute to this community from the very day it was founded in 1636. So that, I think, is important to say. But women were not admitted to Harvard schools and given the opportunity of a Harvard education until the end of the 19th century, when Radcliffe College was founded in order to have a kind of parallel experience. It's an interesting decision. It was a time when some schools were going co-ed. A lot of women's school colleges, like the one I went to, Bryn Mawr College, were being founded. But Harvard was very insistent that women should be kept separate, and the faculty, the male faculty, would go over in the afternoon after they taught the men in the morning to teach the women in the afternoon, and they were kept very rigidly separated. This separation for instruction, with Radcliffe College as a whole separate entity, it wasn't legally part of Harvard University, persisted until the Second World War. And when so many men went off to fight in the war, it just didn't make sense to give a lecture to this paltry number of men and then go over and do it again in the afternoon. So they decided that because of the reduction in the number of male students, they'd just join everybody together. And then once that happened, they never separated classes again. But Radcliffe College actually did not become part of Harvard University until 1999. There were a series of what have been called non-merger mergers and agreements to change the ratio of male to female students, Harvard College to Radcliffe College, over those years. And had I been an undergraduate at Radcliffe, I would not have been permitted in the undergraduate library. Women were not permitted in the undergraduate library until 1967. It was thought that they'd distract the men. That was one explanation. Another explanation was that men had smelly socks and the women shouldn't be submitted to that. I thought that one was very curious. By the time this official merger took place, however, men and women at Harvard, in 1999, men and women at Harvard had essentially been living the same undergraduate student lives since the late 1970s, at least. And so the full participation of women in the college really emerged from that time. Now, this doesn't mean that there are no gender issues at Harvard now. There are, I think, and we talk about them and and address them and encourage the confrontation of issues that concern students on campus. But I think that there's been a remarkable transformation in the environment at Harvard over the last generation, and that it's a place where women thrive and do exceptionally well and find wonderful resources to pursue their dreams just as other students do. So is that kind of what you wanted, that outline, or that was it? Okay.
Thank you.
I once wrote an essay, which you can probably find online, that I gave as a talk on this subject. It's called Mingling Promiscuously. So if you look up my name in Mingling Promiscuously, which is that's a quote from a 19th century Harvardian who said we can't have men and women mingling promiscuously on this campus. Anyway, that is a kind of little essay on the history of women at Harvard that has some very funny anecdotes and some more serious analysis. So check it out if you want a more detailed rendition of this question.
You're welcome.
Hi.
Over here.
Yes.
Hi. Wait, I'm confused. Here, go ahead, ladies first.
Oh, all right. Thanks.
He's single.
I was hoping to get your opinion on something. What with the advent of technology, or I'll stand up, of technology, the internet as a means of educating,
Where are you?
as a thing where information... Hi.
Is that you? Where are you? You're there. Oh, thank you.
Sorry, I'll start again. I was hoping to get your opinion. What with the advent of technology, of the internet as a means of education, where information, knowledge is seemingly readily available, in your opinion, what is the distinguishing value of a college education and maybe furthermore an Ivy League or Harvard education, and how does Harvard uphold that?
This is such a great question, because as we find ourselves able to reach out to the world with MOOCs through edX and HarvardX and think about the digital possibilities for education, it makes us so aware and so much more intentional about what we have to offer one another by being here in this place. One of the core aspects of the undergraduate experience at Harvard is the residential house system. And as you talk to upper class students here, you'll find that they identify themselves. They'll say, I'm John Smith, I'm in Lowell House. It is a critical part of their understanding of themselves, because it's the community in which they are learning as much as they're learning in their classes. So that whole 24/7 aspect of being here live together is a very significant part of what Harvard is. But even apart from the house experience, what happens when you're in the electricity of a classroom and you follow someone from that classroom to have a cup of coffee and you continue that conversation, or you bump into someone in the hallway, or you go with all your classmates to see the basketball team clinch the title and just are happier than you ever thought you could be about basketball. Or you, I'm a basketball fan, so I picked that one. Jeremy Lin, well, yeah. Lots of great people. The live experiences of being here are ones that are just unimaginable as digital experiences. One of the most striking things for me during my 7 years as president is seeing how alums come back because they want it again. They want to sit where you're sitting right now at a reunion with all their friends, because 30 years ago that meant so much to them and they just want a weekend to have it back. Or they want to be involved in volunteer activities at Harvard so that they can build some version of that face-to-face, exciting, energizing experience with people who are like them, extraordinary. So I think you'll find, if you come, and probably wherever you go to a live residential experience, that a big part of it is the living together and the being together and the learning that takes place because of that.
A couple questions from upstairs in the balcony.
Hi. All right, so I was wondering, since Harvard obviously...
Where are you?
Here.
Yes, gotcha. Hi.
All right, so Harvard has, like, really amazing graduate programs, so how do you ensure that there's an adequate focus on undergrads?
People worry about that, and I don't think they should, because the undergraduate college is so much the core of Harvard University, and faculty love to teach in the college. We have faculty from a lot of professional schools who just volunteer. Their responsibility is officially the students in public health or the students in the law school. They want to teach Harvard College undergraduates. And so there's a great opportunity to take advantage of that devotion to Harvard College undergraduates, and to also take advantage of what the graduate school represents, to have the kind of continuity of generations learning, the kinds of participation in a laboratory, for example, that having a graduate student who's working on a project, work together with an undergraduate on a senior thesis, work together with a postdoc, work together with a faculty member. It's a team. And so I think it really enhances what's possible for students in the college in a way that is very significant.
Hi, I'm the gentleman on the bottom. Hi.
My name's... Now it's your turn. Good.
My name's Monty Reed. I'm from the class of 2018. I just wanted to thank you and the admissions office for allowing us the opportunity to change the world. But my question is, what is your fondest encounter with the Harvard students in the past 7 years?
my fondest encounter with Harvard students. Oh, I could tell you a whole bunch in 1 week. How about week before last? When the Harvard basketball team was playing in the NCAA championships, their first game was against the University of Cincinnati. And the University of Cincinnati president called me up and suggested we have a bet that I bet clam chowder, and he would bet some special kind of ice cream from Cincinnati. Anyone here from Cincinnati can tell me what it's called? Yes, Graters, thank you. So he was going to put up ice cream, and I was going to put up clam chowder. And so I consulted with the athletics department. They said, no bets. We don't want to get in any trouble. No bets. Just say, we'll have an exchange. So I said, great. And off I shipped the clam chowder, and the ice cream arrived. And we won the game. And so I invited the men's and women's basketball teams to come for ice cream. And it was just so much fun. First of all, I felt short, which I don't usually feel, because I'm 5'10", and it was a very special day to feel short. It was great ice cream, and they'd won against Cincinnati and then had a great next game and a great season, and it was just terrific to hear their experiences and what they'd gone through. So that was on a Friday. The following Tuesday, I think, I had lunch with the art development fellows. I was talking about one of them in my prepared remarks. And we went around and heard about the different projects that these students who'd been awarded fellowships were going to be involved in, ranging from dance in Israel to the editor of the Lampoon who wants to write a comedic piece based on the experiences she's going to have working in a Pittsburgh newspaper. I'm not sure the Pittsburgh newspaper knows it's going to be turned into a comedic setting. To a student who's going to do extraordinarily advanced work in playing the cello, and just listening to these students, some of whom had discovered their artistic passions for the first time at Harvard. The Lampoon editor had never written comedy before. She did it here. And to think this had happened, they had grown, they were going to continue to grow in the context of Harvard was really exciting. Then the next day, I went to give a talk about the book that Dean Fitzsimmons mentioned. I was invited to speak. This is a kind of odd venue. The Red Sox have a writers' series, and they invite writers to come to a lunch and talk to the Red Sox staff, mostly not the players, but the staff, about a book. So I went to do that. And they'd also invited this subset of the Harvard Glee Club to serenade me before I spoke. And so here was this wonderful group of undergraduates serenading me at lunch. And I thought, I just can't believe it. You know, what a life I get to interact with in a period of 4 days, these students who found different passions, have different talents, and different ways of making the most of their experience at Harvard. So there's an example of just what happened week before last. It's hard to pick a peak thing. Enough, good. A good place to stop. Good.
Okay. Yeah, we'll end on a high.
Thank you very much.
I just want to remind people about the schedule. So we have the parents' reception starting right here in the building at the Queen's Head Pub, sort of across the way and down below. That's at 4:30. We have all the regional meetings coming up, if you look at it. So that's a very good thing. The other thing I just want to mention before you go is that we have a lot of... somebody mentioned Jeremy Lin quietly down here. So I think most of you have probably seen our... Any time I recruit in China, by the way, the way to get a good laugh would be mention Yao Ming or Jeremy Lin. So, you know, it's a winner either way. But if those of you, I think, probably have all seen our video, probably more than you wanted to. But we also have Google Hangouts at 5 o'clock today, a day in the life of a Harvard freshman. Another one at 8 p.m., Multicultural Perspectives. Tomorrow morning at 11:30, International Voices. Sunday at 5:30, Senior Retrospective. And also you can go on Instagram and Tumblr, but also there's some really neat things going on with Twitter. So if you look at hashtag welcome to Harvard, you'll see some pretty interesting stuff. Anyway, thank you. We'll see you around.